Alright, I purchased a shirt that was all signed to a cell phone. Then I'd ask you if you'd help me introduce Father Tom from Oakland as a receiver tonight.
Hi, my name is Tom, and I am an alcoholic, and in great need of 100,000 Al-Anon meetings. When I got sober a while ago, the basic understanding was you were in one program or the other, and there was kind of a line drawn, and at AA meetings, it was not uncommon to make bad Al-Anon jokes. All of them bad, and many of them hostile. But a lot of those folks are dead. And one of the things we've discovered in the last 30 years plus is so many of us need more than one program. I had Al-Anon craziness before I took my first drink. So I'm bilingual, and being this is a special speaking AA and Al-Anon, so I'm going to weave them a little bit together this evening. And if that makes you really upset, you could probably use 100,000 Al-Anon meetings to take the edge off. But I'm a drunk. I'm a falling down drunk, and I'm glad to be here. And I live in Oakland, California, and it's a 4 hour and 20 minute drive, except for today. And there were places where just everything stopped. I don't know why that was true. And somewhere around Atascadero, it was 114 degrees. So that's scary hot. And happy to get here. And that 4.5 hour drive was closer to a five and a half, almost 6 hour drive. And this is an open meeting where we can gather. And those days have been rare over this last while, so I'm glad to be here tonight. And I've met some of you before. Marilyn, I have known Marilyn for 100 years. Marilyn, where are you? For 100 years, Marilyn. We have done great sober things together. And what to share at an AA meeting? I heard Clancy talk about this. And as you know, Clancy passed this past year of the virus. He was 91 or 92, huge influence on many, many people's lives. He and my sponsor were kind of pals, and so I would get a chance to hear him. And they were talking together, and I happened to overhear that, you know, so you hear these sober old guys talk. And what do you share at a meeting? Because you'll hear a lot of things shared. And again, long ago when I first got sober, the norm was you spoke about the drunkalog. And if you were talking for an hour, and Lee tells me I've got about an hour tonight, 58 minutes were the drunkalog. And in the last 2 minutes you say, and then I turned it all over and it's been great ever since. which I don't find helpful, just between us. Also, I've been to meetings where alcohol was never mentioned, and it just felt creepy, you know? So here's what Clancy and Terry were saying. If you're at an AA meeting, you want to mention alcohol. Mention the drinking. If it's an OA meeting, you want to talk about the 12 loaves of French bread, you know? Or 6 pounds of See's candy. That works, too. If it's an Al-Anon meeting, you want to talk about the reasons you go to Al-Anon, you know, and my basic Al-Anon issues are exhaustion and rage. I didn't want to be a sober person who was shooting people. So I started going to Al-Anon, and you mentioned that to alcoholics, and they look confused, and they wonder, well, who would you be shooting? And they don't know that the conversation in deep Al-Anon is, do you shoot to kill or do you shoot to maim? and the room divides, you know, right down the half. And the solution is you can always shoot them tomorrow. We don't shoot them today. And lives are saved over and over and over again. One of my Al-Anon pals has on his desk the word tomorrow. And they think he's quoting Annie, you know, the musical. No, it's, you can always shove them down the stairs tomorrow. Today, no one gets shoved downstairs. Anyway, mention the drinking, you know. So I'm going to do that. Then number two, talk about a recent or current problem. This is so people know you're real. You know, that I've never had a bad day sober. Really? Do you have a week in yet? You know, right? Some days are really very long, and so recent or current problem. And number three, talk about something for which you're really grateful. So I'm going to kind of follow that format tonight. And if I say anything that's helpful, please use it. And if it's not helpful, don't worry about it. I've been living in Oakland since 1981. I got sober in Berkeley in 1976, middle August, Republican convention, Gerald Ford receiving the nomination of his party. And that was my first day without a drink. So you watch TV. Kind of bonded with Mr. Ford right then. Betty had been drinking a little earlier that day. Anyway, I was 29 years old. I'm now in my 75th year. So it's interesting going through your 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, clean and sober. So, and there have been long days and short days. I'm a daily drinker. My sponsor's a periodic. That's not my pattern. I drink pretty much every day. I like everything about alcohol. And I understand it. It's Dr. Silkworth's definition, the allergy of the body and the obsession of the mind, and I've got it. 4th of July, I was telling Lee, I lived in the Bay Area most of my life. I've never been to Alcatraz because that's for tourists. That's for tourists. Well, a few weeks ago, we found out that the five of us who lived in the Bay Area all of our lives, none of us had been to Alcatraz. So out of shame, on the 4th of July, we went to Alcatraz. Looked around, saw stuff, left there, then went to Pier 39 for dinner, which is another zillion tourists. Went to a fancy place. And of the five of us, two of us are sober in the program. So I ordered an iced coffee, and my pal Jim H. ordered an iced tea. And then we have three people who drink alcohol but don't go to jail. One of them every evening has one double scotch. And I don't want to scare people. I've lived with him for 30 years. Just this past year, because of quarantine and you're home all the time, I noticed he uses a shot glass. My blood ran backwards. Have you ever seen anybody use a shot glass? What's wrong with... But he has one double touch. Anyway, Margarita, and then the fellow over here, named John, ordered a fancy beer. This was a week ago. It must have been 18 inches high. Clear glass, this beautiful amber, ice cold, all sparkly and stuff. I could not take my eyes off it. And I wanted to reach across and grab it and pick it up and just kiss it a little. And then put it back down again. but I can do that tomorrow. I don't have to do that today. But this is 44 years of sobriety. I can still see it if I just close my eyes and my pulse jump. So my experience is my thinking does not get healthier, but I've learned some things. Right? It's not his fault. And I'm just allergic to some stuff and obsessed with them. So that's me. But I love beer and I love hard liquor and I love bourbon. And I popped, when I was a little kid, there's booze in the house and there's alcoholics in the family, of course. But I remember going to get a bottle of bourbon. My dad was a bourbon drinker. And get a mouthful of bourbon. And then go to the refrigerator and take a can of Hershey syrup and take a mouthful of Hershey syrup. Now in fancy hotels, those are called Brandy Alexanders. But that's not bad for 8 years old. And I at high school, I loved everything about alcohol, and this is how I perceived it. You want to hold your liquor. If you can hold your liquor, you're very adult. You're very adult. You're very mature. You're very masculine. If you don't drink, you're kind of a loser. And I want to associate with a heavy drinking crowd. And by the time I was 16 and 17 and 18 years old, I was known for being a pretty heavy drinker. And I loved that. I heard that as high praise. In college, someone started spreading the rumor that I was a major alcoholic, and I took pride in that. I mean, you know, look at me, you know. So I heard a woman named Phoebe years ago at a meeting say this. Alcohol did something for me, and then alcohol did something to me. Bingo. One of the men I've loved, Dr. Gil A., he's been gone now maybe 10 years, but Gil died in his 90s, grew up in French Canada during the Prohibition in the United States. He went through medical school, came to San Francisco, began his medical practice, got sober in the late 1950s. And Gil spent most of his medical life helping people get well. And he would talk about alcoholism to doctors and healthcare professionals. Tough bunch to talk to. And he would talk about the allergy of the body and the obsession of the mind. And he'd talk about symptoms. And he'd talk about progression. And he would talk about the fatality of it. You know, this kills us. And he would say this. Now this is a very thoughtful and wise, well-educated man with a beautiful French accent. And he said, alcoholism is a disease that has three distinct phases. Phase one is the fun phase. This is when it's really fun. And I had fun for a really long time. I felt magical when I drank. I was hilarious when I drank. I had such deep insights when I drank. I could do things, you know, all fearless. Fun. Stage two alcoholism is called fun plus trouble. Or fun plus problems. It's still fun. But there's trouble and there's problems. And stage three alcoholism is just called trouble or problems. And if we were not crazy people, when the trouble and the problem became big, we'd stop. Not me. When I would get into trouble, I would get sneaky and I'd hide and I'd lie and I'd hope not to be noticed and I'd get more and more isolated. And there's 1,000 examples of that in my life. I heard this at a meeting in Fremont, Okay, that's kind of between Oakland and San Jose is Fremont. I think it's the last town in Alameda County before you spill over into San Jose. This fellow said alcoholism was a lot like dancing with a gorilla. You're not done dancing until the gorilla is done dancing. Just to make it nice and clear. Even if you're taller than the gorilla, or faster than the gorilla, or smarter than the gorilla, once the gorilla gets his arms around you, the gorilla is the one making decisions, just so you know. And it kills a lot of us. You know, that if you love an alcoholic, if you love an addict, there's casualties and losses and grief. There's a whole part of Al-Anon conversation about loss and grief, about things that couldn't happen but never did, and things that shouldn't have happened but did, and opportunities and hopes, and of course, fatalities. If you're clean and sober today, it means the gorilla has let go. If the gorilla has let go, you want to get out of the cage. And you don't want to go back into the cage, even if the gorilla starts humming your song. Suddenly you hear music and it's magic and it'll be different this time. One of my pals in Las Vegas says he doesn't want to dance with the gorilla, but every so often he wants to pet it just a little bit. And you just end up dead. I'll get back to the gorilla story. When I was at the end of my drinking and beginning of my sobriety, I'm in Berkeley. I'm studying theology at the Jesuit School of Theology, part of the Graduate Theological Union. We had 12 different schools, 9 different denominations. It was a wonderful place to learn. And you learn this and you learn that and you learn the pastoral stuff comes up. And one of the things I was reading about and listening about was people who were involved with battering spouses and battering families. And you get beaten up and you get hospitalized, and then you go back to the batterer. And this is a deep craziness. Because why would you do that? Well, he said he'd be better. Oh, we all believe you. So what occurred to me was that was my relationship with alcohol. It would beat me senseless, and I'd go back to it. One more time into the cage. It'll be different this time because I'm not mixing beer and wine. See, it'll be different this time because I've eaten first. It'll be different this time because I'm not driving. You know, all that stuff. Whew. The battering spouse syndrome. My relationship with alcohol. Now, we who love addicts and alcoholics, and they're cute, you know? And sometimes they're fun. We who love addicts and alcoholics visit the zoo a lot. And you walk in and you look around and there's lions and there's tigers and there's bears, there's giraffes, you know? I mean, this is a wonderful place. And then you walk by the gorilla cage. And you see the person you love with the gorilla. And you go wild. Now, it might be your spouse. I've never been interested in marrying an alcoholic. Why would you do that, however? People do all the time. So it might be your spouse. It might be your mom or dad. Might be one of your kids or grandkids. And those are different crazinesses. Like, I know people who think everything is perfect and
they've been sober a long time, and they're sponsoring thousands of people, and they know the Big Book backwards and forwards, and they have nothing but answers. And then their oldest granddaughter goes into treatment again. And boy, are they back at step one. Just with a fear no one else has, except another parent or grandparent. So anyway, the person we love is, something must be done! So we get into the cage. We will fix this. We will start sweeping and vacuuming. We'll move the furniture around. We'll hang nice pictures, Chinese poetry. None of that helps. Vegan meals, none of that helps. So we try to get between the gorilla and the person we love and pull them apart, and the gorilla turns on us and yanks our arms and legs off. The casualty rates among those of us who love addicts and alcoholics is very, very high. We get damaged physically and emotionally and spiritually. So we have a program, and it's called Al-Anon. And a lot of the Al-Anon program comes down to this. Stay out of the cage. Let's say that together. Stay out of the cage. But I only want to sweep and vacuum. We know. And it just makes everything worse. So, we're meeting over by the giraffes. And we will discuss why we think it's important for us to clean up other people's cages and get involved in stuff that there's nothing we can do about. Because it's a deep, deep craziness. Whew. I was at a meeting, one of the first in-person meetings I've been to, about 6 weeks ago now. It was in Alameda, which is a funny little island. And this person, I never go there, this person said, let's see, he was brand new at meetings, and someone sat him down and said, we're going to work steps together. And they said, okay. So, question number one, to this new guy. Can you drink safely?
No.
Is your life a mess?
Yes.
That's step one. Do you think we can help?
I hope so.
That's step two. Are you willing to do the footwork?
That's step three.
Now let's do an inventory. You know, end of the first meeting. Let's get going, you know, on a program of recovery. Whew. So the first step asks the question, are you still having any fun? And if you're still having fun, we do not look good to you. Oh, let's go to Orca and hear an old guy talk. Oh, yeah. Let's do that on a Saturday night. But if you have the gift of desperation, this isn't such a bad thing. Happens too with Al-Anon. I usually, when I mention I'm an Al-Anon member because I don't want to be a sober person shooting people. And I did this at a meeting in Marin County, and a lady came up to me and she said, I'm 7 years sober and I hate everybody. Should I start going to Al-Anon? And I told her, hold out as long as you can. You don't want to rush your recovery, you know? Because if you get there too early, you're going to notice the differences. Oh, they're too old, and oh, good heavens, someone's missing, and Or if someone's holding this stuffed animal, you go, oh, please, I have too much selfish to come back to this meeting. But if you're bleeding and on fire, you'll be glad to be there. I'm just so glad to be here. I was telling someone, I'm looking for a good Al-Anon meeting. I said, you don't need you just need an Al-Anon meeting. It's like I'm looking for a good chemotherapist, you know. Any chemotherapist will save your life, you know. Go now. I didn't have a lot of trouble with step one. I'm a little depressed anyway. And I listen to the news, so I know there's very little hope. And that this huge train wreck is happening, and it's been going on since Adam and Eve left the garden, so I'm pretty aware of that. Powerless and unmanageable. Coming down a 101, I knew that when everything just stopped. I didn't get panicky or anything. There's nothing I can do about this, and we're just going to, you know, keep the air conditioning on and follow directions. My trouble has been step two. Because the way I understand that step two came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Step two is about getting some hope. Is there a way out of this cage, out of this trap, out of this pit, out of this train wreck? Is there a way out? And step two lets me know there's a way out. You can be restored to sanity by a power greater than yourself. It's not you. But there's energy. There's a power greater than yourself, who is evidently willing to help if I'm willing to be helped. And I went to meetings, and I went to meetings, and I went to meetings, and maybe in 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 months sober, I had this realization that I was not the only person in the room. And I've always been the only person in the room. I mean, I'm better than you, I'm worse than you, but I'm not like you. I'm unique, and I'm special, and I'm different. And one day there was this awareness that recovery is possible for anyone in the room, and I'm in the room. When I was 20 years sober, I thought I'd take a week off and go to a monastery in New Mexico, in a place called Abiquiu, in middle of a canyon, eagles. It's where Georgia O'Keeffe did a lot of painting. If you know Georgia O'Keeffe, and if you've seen her remarkable landscapes, you would say, what an imagination she has, until you go there and see, it's no imagination, that's what it looks like, these spectacular New Mexico vistas. So I went there for a week to a Benedictine monastery, and I joined the monks for various things, and then I slept and I read, and I slept and I read. I remember walking with one of the monks, it was kind of towards sundown, and there was a rattlesnake across the road, right there. And you're supposed to shoot them, kill them, do something, you know. Where's your hatchet? And this monk picked up a stick and took the snake and he threw it into the brush. And I said to him, why didn't you kill it? And he said, they were here first. Now, what kind of thinking is that, I ask you? So, but I would read the book and I would sleep and I'd read the book and I wondered about things. I thought at 20 years of sobriety, I should have some profound insights that I could talk about a lot. And I just nothing, you know. Except this. The question was, how do you get from a place of no hope, powerless, unmanageable, doomed? The sun is burning out. everything's awful. How do you get from that place to a place where there's some hope? And it became clear to me at 20 years of sobriety and lots of meetings, I did not think my way from step one to step two. I did not run from step one to step two. I didn't march. I didn't walk. I didn't even crawl. I got carried from step one to step two. From the women and men in rooms like these, a power greater than myself took me from a place of being very isolated and very unique and very special and very different to a place where I was a member of a community of people getting well. I did not do step two, I received step two. And life started happening again. You got to make choices and decisions and move and do stuff, and there's lots of changes. At the end of a year's sobriety, I left Berkeley. I finished my schooling. I passed my coursework. Not gloriously, but I passed my coursework. And then I went back to work. I went back to teach in Los Angeles. And I had this huge crisis. And here's the crisis. Wherever you get sober is where they do it right. And if you move anywhere else, it's a nightmare. I mean, how do these people call themselves sober? Don't they know you're supposed to do X, Y? So I went from very low-key AA with small meetings and not very well-lit rooms. Discussion, we're very democratic, small discussion meetings, lots of those, to Los Angeles where there are huge rooms, very well lit, very perky, very upbeat, very glad to see you, and greeters at the door, and happiness every, boy, that was rough. I didn't know how to make friends. I didn't know how to say hello. And I finally asked my sponsor, are there any small meetings? Because I might make friends better at small meetings. And he said, try a big book study. They are always small. And I found a big book meeting on Friday night at a Korean church on Olympic Boulevard. And there were 12 to 18 regulars, women and men in their 40s, 50s, and 60s. I had just turned 30. And over the next year or two, they became my first friends. Hanging out and saying hello and making the phone calls and working real hard. And I just want to say two or three things about going back to my profession as a teacher, as a sober person. It's like I knew nothing. I didn't feel confident or skillful or hopeful. I was a very successful teacher when I'd been there before, and I was drinking a lot, almost every evening. And there were times I should not have been in the classroom. I was too hungover. But I was a very successful teacher. And clean and sober, now in my second and third year of sobriety, the great shock that I discovered about me was how afraid I was of my students, which I had never noticed before, because I was sedated. And when I stopped the drinking, anger came up, of course, because a lot of us have vast amounts of anger. But under the anger for me was a lot of fear, and I really didn't know that. What a surprise. What an embarrassment. And I was seeing a therapist. His name was Dr. Paul Ackerman. And I think I saw him for a couple of months. We didn't bond and become best friends. But I was sober, and I knew I was in trouble about some things. And he gave me some helpful pointers.
And one of the things he told me in dealing with kids, high school kids, right, was when you walk across the schoolyard, walk, don't run. If you're really afraid, you might just want to run so like they can't see you or get you, but that just builds the fear. Walk slowly, look at the kids in the face, touch them on the arm, say hello, have a conversation. And I started doing that, going slower, engaging a little bit, and some of the fear began to dissipate. But that was real hard work. When I was 5 years sober, I decided it was time to leave the classroom because I didn't like kids anymore. And that's when it's time to leave. And I went back to Oakland, and I've done a whole bunch of things since. But I remember talking to my sponsor that this is the decision-making process. You know, a lot of us come into recovery, and we wake up. We come to, we start getting well, and we find out that what we could do in sickness, we can't do in recovery. I know nurses in Al-Anon who are emergency room nurses, because it reminds them of home. you know, emergencies and drama and sirens and cops. And after a while, you don't have to do that anymore. You might go into pediatrics, you know, changing the career. I sponsored a fellow named Charlie, still sober, but Charlie ran a garage in Berkeley called Charlie's Garage. And when I moved up to the Bay Area, I went to meetings and I said, where is there an honest garage? Charlie's Garage. So I started going there, a bunch of us went going there. And then one night, after a couple of years, Charlie showed up at a meeting. Now, the nightmare scenario is you go to your first AA meeting and it's full of people you know, right? Charlie saw half the room were his clients. And he almost ran for his life out the door. He said, no, 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 come in, come in, come in. He really was in trouble, and he got sober, did lots of service. He was wonderful to hang out with. But after he was sober a couple of years, I was his sponsor, and he said, I have to talk to you. He said, I'm tired of being a mechanic. He was close to 50 years old. And I said, well, how did you become a mechanic? He said, I was a kid. I repaired cars in the backyard. I was 14, 15, 16 years old. It was really fun. It was magical. I'm bored out of my mind. I want to sell the garage and go back to school and learn computers. And my first thought was, where will I take my car? And I was going to tell him how you shouldn't make a major change for the first 20 years of your recovery, you know. But he did. He went through all that. He went through making decisions. I was done teaching, and I didn't know what else I wanted to do. There was the possibility of social work in West Oakland. That is the job I took. I learned a zillion things I never wanted to know. Boy, did I get into Al-Anon. But I talked to my sponsor, and I said, how do you make decisions? And he said, well, you know, option one, option two, option three, the pros and cons, pros and cons, pros and cons. I mean, this is nothing fancy. This is very ordinary. So pros and cons, pros and cons, pros and cons. One of my options was to leave the United States and go to Scandinavia. Because no one there has a bad day, you know. I'll go there and be fixed. Geographical cure. So I did all that, and I showed him my work. He barely looked at it. And I said, so what should I do? And he said, well, for the last 4 years you've been teaching kids. Highly structured, bells ringing all day long, 18-hour days, and you stayed sober. He said, that's an accomplishment. Your new job, social work West Oakland, looks like it has no structure at all. I mean, you'll literally be learning how to do this by the seat of your pants. You'll be making it up as you go along. And so the question is, do you want to see if you can say sober there? And I said, but what should I do, you know? And he said, you could do either one. It can only be a terrible mistake. One of the better conversations we ever had. He said, you made a billion mistakes to get here. You'll continue making mistakes all the time. We have a whole step focusing on that. When wrong, promptly admitting it. Clean up your mess and go do something else. He said, you're going to be fine, but get in the pool and see if you can swim. And so I took the job in West Oakland. I kept it for 3 years, and then I let go of it. But boy, I learned a lot of stuff, a lot of which I never wanted to know. And boy, did I have to work a different kind of program, because the pressures were different and difficult, and the obligations were difficult. And I was dealing with adults, not kids again. It was very, very different, highly challenging and wonderful. I was at a meeting in Texas, Saturday night meeting, men's retreat. And this guy was talking about the Serenity Prayer. And he said, when we're making decisions, you want serenity. You don't want to make decisions upset or enraged or terrified or bleeding and on fire. I mean, that's not the time to make decisions, you know. I love you, what's your name? Might not be the time to make a decision. So give me some serenity, and then there's things I cannot change, and there's things I can change. And he said, here are three things I cannot change. I cannot change the past. And I cannot change the truth. And I cannot change you. Now that frees up the whole day, you know? Because I can do a lot of stuff about things that happened or didn't happen in the past and the time. I can spend a lot of time there. I can't change the truth. What's the truth? Laws of physics. What goes up comes down. That applies to everything. To every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. The speed of light. Gravity. I mean, the truth. Every so often I think I'm so spiritual, gravity shouldn't apply to me. Whew. And I can't change you. And I heard this in Al-Anon. Loving someone does not change them. It changes me. And hating someone does not change them. It changes me. And I'm in my 75th year. I'm much closer to 80 than 50. So I don't have time or energy to waste on stuff I can't change. And I have to be very clear on that. What about? Here and now today, Orchid, California, almost sundown, this is what's real. But what about? This is what's real. And this is where I want to be. So what can I change? And this guy said, here are three things I can change. I can change my thinking. I can change my behavior. And I can change my attitudes. Which is the focus of the program, and it is the focus of this. Changing my thinking. Not only do I need new information, I have to rewire my whole brain. Because I have a lot of stimulus response here that isn't helpful. Verbally and other, in Narcotics Anonymous they say, first thought wrong. And I don't want to say the first thing that comes to mind, the first several things that come to mind. Here's one of the worst things I've ever done. I'm giving a talk. There's a group of very nice older folks mostly called the Sarah Club, not Sierra, Sarah Club, and they try to support priests and they try to support people in studies, but they're lovely, mostly older people. And somehow they got my name. So would I come and have lunch and give an inspiring little talk about what I get to do? Okay, so I go to Santa Clara, and it's a room full of nice people, and I'm talking about, I've done some work in Southeast Asia, I've taught English over there, I've taught in Vietnam, I've taught in Myanmar, I've taught in mainland China, I've taught in Thailand, I've been in lots of places, I mean, I all this stuff in Myanmar going on right now, I just heard from some students of mine, they're still alive, but oh my goodness. Anyway, so I talked about all of that. I've had a pretty interesting life, and then I mentioned that I was an alcoholic in recovery, and I haven't had a drink in a long time. Any questions? And a lady of a certain age raised her hand, and she said, "So you're an alcoholic?" I said, "I am." "How old were you when you started drinking?" "Well, you know, with any regularity, what, 15? 14, 15, 16, I said about that. And then she said, "You should be ashamed of yourself." I was caught completely by surprise. I did not expect that. And I heard myself say, "You are too old to be that stupid." First thought wrong, you know what I mean? And I apologized, and I you know, tried to make amends, and I saw her one-on-one afterwards, and I apologized, and she said, "You don't have to tell me, I was married to three of them." So, goodness me. I have never been asked back, which is fine with me. Gratitude stuff. March of 2020, I went down to Bakersfield, Fresno. I got to give a talk like this. This is before quarantine. And then we went on a cruise, would you believe, the west coast of Mexico. But we did, and we're all alive. But I was in Fresno, Bakersfield, and they have a fundraiser for central office. I think it's called Take Your Sponsor to Dinner. And it's pasta and salad and French bread and all is good, and I met some of the old-timers there. And they were talking about changes, and you know, alcoholics don't like changes. We're opposed. And they said in the late 1950s, the discussion in that part of California was about a change. Should we get a telephone for central office? Because real alcoholics write a letter to New York. And then New York writes back. There's a bunch of correspondence. Bill W. writing people, a lot of that. And a telephone is newfangled and modern, and do we really need it? And because they're alcoholics, this was discussed for 3 months. And then they got one, and the world's been different. So, got on the boat, they all took our temperatures, they were very careful with everything, got off the boat, saw my sponsor, came back home, quarantined the next day. And within a week, resuming. The technological adaptation was really fast, because it was a great need. I have a couple of friends who are opposed to everything modern. And one or two of them have refused Zoom because they don't like the idea. And they're much crazier than you and I will ever be one day at a time.
I've been very grateful for the Zoom connection. I mean, it really is a gratitude thing. And how creative people are, and how you can go to meetings all over the world. One of the things I got a text message from a guy named Hamid. And would I be willing to talk at a meeting in Iran? And it'll be translated. And I got that opportunity. I've done that twice. And Iran is a whole different setup. It's not Zoom, it's something else. And they have different rules and regulations because alcohol is forbidden. It's a Muslim country. And the Quran forbids that. And so anonymity is extremely important in that part of the world. Drug addicts, you can tell anyone you're a heroin addict. There's no way, but I got the chance to share experience, strength, and hope. What a gift. And in Jerusalem, and in Tokyo, and in Los Angeles, you know, these exotic places. I'm very grateful for the Zoom connection. And I've also noticed people getting sober on Zoom. I mean, how is that even possible? People getting sober on Zoom. My Tuesday night meeting. 2 weeks ago, we had 5 brand new people. 6 days of sobriety, 8 days of sobriety. What a gift. I asked my sponsor once, and I'm almost done. I asked my sponsor once, you know, how do you know, what's God's will all about? And he said, it is God's will for each of us to have a life. Go get one. Which again, making decisions and making mistakes and trying things out and see what works, it's very practical. And the program that I practice, it's very simple and it's very practical. You know, you don't take the first drink. You ask God for help. You return phone calls. Make your bed frequently. My sponsor does it every day, but I just don't have that depth. But I made it today before I came here, so I wouldn't be ashamed when I talk to you. And you know, how do you know you're growing? How do you know you're, because so many of us come in and we're very immature in 10 ways. So how do you know you're growing? Sister Wendy said, you know you're growing spiritually if you're any easier to live with. So ask the family, you know, am I any easier to live with? And Terry said on one occasion, you know, if you find yourself really happy when someone else is getting well, that's really a good sign. It's really a good sign of your recovery. You're taking joy in someone else's life, and you're not being competitive or trying to be faster, more strong. There is a delight and a joy in the room. New people coming in. You saw that tonight as people were receiving acknowledgments of periods of times of sobriety. There's joy there. And that's a good thing. We are not a glum lot. And that's such good news. So I think that's everything I know. I'm really glad to be here. If you come up to the Bay Area ever, or you're Zooming, there is a Zoom noontime old-timers meeting in Oakland. You can go to eastbayaa.org or the Tuesday night meeting at 6:30. I'm almost always there. And we're sure glad you're alive. Okay, bye.
Thank you, Bill. All right, another round of applause.